The Theosophical Society presents Clara Codd in a talk entitled Arcane Schools of the Past and Future.
I'm going to read quite a lot tonight because this is what I call a student's lecture. You know, I'm going to talk about the arcane schools of the past and also the future, what we can know of them. Now, what were the arcane schools of the past? They were what we call the ancient mysteries. And I think from when I made a study of them once, from what you can learn about them, which isn't very much, because it all took place under a vow of complete secrecy. But from what I learnt of them, I think they were the ancient universities. And the coping stone of those universities was spiritual knowledge. It would be rather wonderful if we could have universities like that again in these days. And it had its professors and its scholars. And the professors were adepts and initiates. And the scholars came from all over the known world of those days. Now, this is what HBB says about the ancient mysteries. She says, they have ever been made a discipline and a stimulus to virtue, because they taught something of what they call in the East the Gupta Vidya. That means the sacred science. And there's always been those two sides, the exoteric and the esoteric. You know, St. Ambrose once said that the Christian religion, that was in the early days, I'll come to that last of all, that the Christian religion had shallows in which a child could wade and depths in which a giant could swim. Now, it was always in the hand of the sacred brotherhood, and I think they deputed some of their initiates and disciples to teach in the sacred, in the ancient mysteries. And St. Clement says something about that too. He says, the gnosis, the knowledge itself, which has is that which has descended by transmission to a few, having been imparted unwritten to the apostles. Then he had a disciple called Origen. And Origen says, God the Word was sent as a physician to sinners, but as a teacher of divine mysteries to those who are already pure and sin no more. Now, before I go on to the great cultic mysteries, I want to point out that a great deal of tradition still persists among savage tribes. You know, the mystery institutions and the ritual arcane schools of the past are very ancient. They come all the way down from ancient Atlantis. It's possible that they came from the planet Venus with the Lords of the Flame 6.5 million years ago. Because you'll find traditions, symbols, actions, which belong to them among now what are savage tribes. For instance, the Red Indians. And the Red Indians, you know, are descendants, the last petering out remnants of what was the mightiest nation of Atlantis, and that was the Toltecs. And a long time ago, when I first came to America, I tried to find a real Red Indian chief. A real one, you know. And at last I found one. And he came along to see me, all in his feathers and everything else. And I asked him to tell me about his ancient religion. Oh no, he said, nobody wants to know. And then I offended the poor man very much because I said, aren't all you Red Indians now Roman Catholics? He was horrified. But however, in the long run, I won him round and he told me a lot. And he drew me symbols and told me the colours, and I can't remember most of them now. But they did remind me of what you will see on the pylons and temples reproduced, I've seen them, in ancient Egypt. Now that was very interesting because, you know, ancient Egypt was a colony of the Toltecs, and the pyramids were built by the Toltec people. So you see the connection. Now the other races, you'll even find it among the Zulus in Africa, and you'll find it among what is supposed to be the most degenerate native people in the world, the Australian Aborigines. Now when I was in Australia, this was in a Masonic lodge in Australia, I heard a lecture by a mason, he was a male mason, who when he was a little boy had lived on his uncle's farm in Queensland. And the only playmate that he had was the son of the local chief, the Aboriginal chief. He had nobody else to play with. They were very great friends. So when the day came that the chief's little son was to be initiated into the mysteries of the tribe, this always takes place among savage people when the boy is approaching puberty and can be included amongst the males of the tribe. Before that, he's always with the women and children. Well, when that day came, the little English boy, little Australian boy, wanted to join in too. So at last the Aboriginal chief agreed that the little boy should come in too. But he explained to the uncle that they would have to go several days stark naked. Well, the uncle at last agreed the little boy could take part, and that's all right, but he had stipulated that he'd be allowed to wear a pair of boots. And that always made me smile, because if you think a little boy go along with nothing on but a pair of boots. But what he told us was that he had to spend several days without food and one of them on all night on the top of a high mountain, and several tests. It always begins with tests of endurance. And then when he was initiated along with the little Aboriginal boy, long years afterwards, when he was a mason, he recognized some of the signs. Now you see, I always thought it got nothing to do with the Jews. The ancient Masonic signs come right down from the days of Atlantis. They're very, very ancient. Now Bishop Leadbeater told us the same thing when he was a boy in Peru. He made great friends with the natives there. And the descendant of the ancient Incas, once a year, in ordinary life he was a house painter, once a year he put on the feather cloak, and in a retired valley where nobody knew where they were, he went through the ancient ceremonies of Peru. And they allowed Bishop Leadbeater, when he was a little boy, to watch from the top of a hill. And he said he afterwards recognized again, like the other man did, several of the signs and symbols. So I'm just mentioning this because I want you to see how very, very ancient the whole thing is. And now I will tell you about Mr. Gilmore. Mr. Gilmore was tremendous friends with Zulus. I don't know whether they still continue this. Perhaps they do in the Zulu reservations. But you know, he was great friends with the Zulus, and they allowed him to witness quite a great deal, but not all, of their rites of initiation to the boys. He said the one thing that immensely impressed him was that the boys first of all went through what a Catholic would call a kind of retreat. And there they were instructed by the chiefs. And Mr. Gilmore listened to a great deal. And he said he was very much impressed with the very splendid teaching the boys had and how the chiefs instructed them in the science of eugenics. And I thought, well, that's really wonderful, because nobody instructs Western boys in the science of eugenics. And then he said that when the day of initiation came, the boys were clothed in a special robe, and they were taken to a very secluded spot, and if any woman approached, they would have been killed. And then they went through rites, so he didn't see all of this, that marked the assumption of the duties and rights of manhood. And one part of it was they were laid in a symbolic grave. Do you notice that that takes place in nearly all initiation ceremonies? Why, some of it's come down in the Roman Catholic Church. Man Bavesky says that. And do you notice that when a monk or a nun or a priest is professed or consecrated, that they lie on their face in a symbolic grave, and that when they arise, they have a new name. So these are common to all. And whilst I'm thinking about it, let us remember several sayings in the Book of Revelations. You know, the Book of Revelation, I'm quite sure, is nothing to do with the end of the world. but I think it's a glyph or allegory of the progress of the soul through the path of initiation. I think there's certain one of our ancient theosophists who've written a book on that subject, Mr. Kingsland. For instance, you take the seven churches of Ephesus. They aren't seven churches, they're the seven chakrams in the physical body. And then do you notice how very often there's the phrase occurs, to him that overcometh? Because all initiations are preceded by tests. To him that overcometh, I will give him a white robe. Now, of course, the white robe is really emblematic of the purity of the astral body. To him that overcometh, I will give him a crown of life. And don't you know what that really is? You know, when we aspire, little flames shoot upwards like this. No, an initiate is in a state of continual conscious, subconscious aspiration. He's always got those flying sparks, and it gives him the appearance of a crown. And then to him that overcometh, I will give him a white stone and a new name written therein, which no man knoweth, saving only him that receiveth it. Now, a lot of Masons will understand that. And not only that, but you see the new name. When, for instance, a nun is professed, she becomes Sister Agatha or something like that. They have a new name. Well, don't you see what all that means? Because in the real initiations, when they really take place on the path, at the first initiation, the initiate hears his immortal name. I wonder if you all realize that we all have an immortal name. Now, it isn't a name that you can put into words and write down, but it's our particular chord in the harmony of nature. And it is possible to hear that in very deep meditation. You hear your own name, so to say. Do you see that? Then I want to come to the cultic mysteries. Now they belong to the great religions. There was the Egyptian, they were very famous, and the Chaldean, and the Greek. I know more about the Greek than any other, the Pythagorean. There were the Druidic mysteries. If ever you cross the strait in the north of Wales and pass into that the island at the top of Wales, you'll be immensely impressed by the extraordinary atmosphere. It's still there. That was where the Druids used to celebrate their mysteries. And then there were the Essene mysteries, the Gnostics, early Christians, and all of them had 3 degrees. Well, just like the Masons have. The Pythagorean, the first degree, was called the Hearers. It lasted for 2 years. And they were called the Hearers because they were not allowed to speak or ask questions. The second degree was called the Learned. And among other things, they learned music and mathematics. The third degree was called the Perfect. And occasionally, they had a fourth degree called the Adepts. Now, the Druids had 3 degrees. The first degree was called the Ubates, and the second, the Bards, and the third, the Full Druids. They taught reincarnation, among other things. The Essenes had 3 degrees, and you will come across a great many Essene terms in the New Testament. The first was called the Little Child. Now, when the Christ took a little child and placed him in the midst, I don't think it was a physical little child, it was a neophyte. The second degree was called the Brethren, and the third degree was called the Perfect, something like the Pythagoreans. Now, St. Paul was an initiate in the Essene mysteries. I'll come to them at the end of what I'm talking about, because St. Clement of Alexandria tells us a lot about them. And you remember where he wrote, "We speak wisdom amongst them which be perfect. Not the wisdom of this world, but we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, even the hidden wisdom, which God ordained before the world was unto our glory, which none of the princes of this world knew. For had they known it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. Well, the early church, the exoteric early church, had a preliminary decree called the Catechumens. Now, they all had certain factors in common. They were all celebrated either at the vernal or the autumnal equinox. They were all preceded by preliminary periods of purification and instruction. This is what the Catholics would call a retreat. They all took place at sacred spots, either at a temple or a cave or a pyramid or even the Round Towers in Ireland, or at special sacred groves, but they took place at a sacred spot. All the candidates went through a symbolic death representing the death of the god. They went through wanderings through the underworld. Then came the appearance of light and the appearance of the gods. And then the candidate, having passed through all this, was crowned, robed, a ring was put on his finger, he was said to be saved. You know, with the first initiation, the Hierophant now says to the candidate, "Now thou art safe forever. May thou reach soon the other shore." Well, now there's two mysteries that I want to talk about, because that's the Egyptian and the Greek, and I say a little about the Christian mysteries. Now, I don't know very much about the Egyptian mysteries, but I read a book once which was a very free translation of the Book of the Dead. And the Book of the Dead, you know, has a great deal of mystery ritual in it. And a great deal of the Christian creed and ritual comes from that. Now, this is a very free translation. I can't guarantee to you that it's the real correct one. And it took place at the Temple of Osiris in Thebes. Thebes was called the City of the Sun. It was the sacred city. And these are the words. Blind soul, arm thyself with the torch of the mysteries, and in the night of earth thou shalt uncover thy luminous double, thy celestial soul. Follow this divine guide, and let him be thy guide, for he holds the key to thy lives, both past and present. Then the candidate says, "Shall I see the light of Osiris? Because Egypt taught the doctrine of the Logos light." Remember the famous saying of Hermes, "Thou art the light, let that light shine." And then the Hierophant replies, "That does not depend upon us. Truth is not given. It is found in oneself or not found at all. We cannot make an adept of thee. Thou must become one thyself. Long does the lotus press upwards beneath the surface of the stream before spreading out its petals to the light. Hasten not the unfolding of the divine flower. It will come in due season. Work and pray." And then, having proved himself, the very test, which is sometimes called the test of earth, air, fire, and water, the Hierophant then says to the candidate, "Thou art about to enter into the mighty ineffable communion of the initiates, for thou art worthy by thy purity of heart, thy love of truth, and power of abnegation. No one crosses the threshold of Osiris without passing through death and resurrection. Fear not, for thou art already one of the brethren." The candidate was then conducted into the king's chamber in the Great Pyramid. Now, the king's chamber in the Great Pyramid was not a burial place. It was a place of initiation. And he was laid in the sarcophagus, and he set free of his body. The sarcophagus held his body safely till he came back. Now, I will tell you, just to pause for a moment, that there are great underground temples in Ireland, near New Grange, about 20 miles from Droida. And one day, Mr. Pellew and I went off to see them. They're in a very lonely spot. There are two of them. And it's a great mound with monoliths all round. And one little tiny doorway with cuneiform writing that nobody has yet deciphered. Now, you have to take a candle or a lantern, and you have to stoop your head as you walk in. But we walked in, and we down and down till we came to a vast underground temple. It was much bigger than this tent and much higher. I couldn't see the top. And at the end, there was three alcoves like this in the form of a cross. And in each of them, there was a sarcophagus and another one in the middle, four. And I noticed one thing about the Irish sarcophagi. You know, in Egypt, you can put the body out full length. But the Irish sarcophagi were much too short for the body to lie full length. So I saw at once what was the reason for that. They put the body in the position. Sometimes they did that. They sometimes buried them like that. They put the body in the position of the child before birth. That was why the sarcophagi was so short, you see. Well, and I think the round towers were used for something like that. Well, you know, the round tower doors, unless you had a ladder, you couldn't get in. But I heard Bishop Leadbeater say that they were entered by the etheric double, not by the physical body. Now, I want to come back to Egypt. So then he was laid there, and then he spent 3 days and nights, I don't know whether it was a full, really 3 days and nights, in the underworld, learning the conditions of life after death, and giving proof that he knew how to preach to the spirits in prison. Now, do you remember the Christian creed and how he entered into the hell and preached to the spirits in prison? Well, all initiates have to do that. And giving proof. He was brought back to consciousness by being stretched upon a cross like this, outside the pyramid, where the first rays of the rising sun could touch his forehead and call him back to earth. And you know, if you were to go to Stonehenge on Salisbury Plain, what they call the pointer, the big stone, on midsummer morning, the sun's rays touch it exactly. Well, there doesn't that remind you, see, there he was, and he was called back to earth by the rising sun. Now, when the Hyksos conquerors came into Egypt, the mysteries went underground, so to say, because they were rather savage people, the Hyksos conquerors, and they were preserved very secretly. And Hermes, the thrice greatest, he was called another name by the Egyptians, something beginning with T, I forgot it for a moment. Hermes, the thrice greatest, writes to a Greek disciple he had called Asclepius, and he says, "O Egypt, Egypt, there will remain for thee, for future generations, only fables that no one will believe. Nothing of thee will endure except words cut out in stone." Now, Alexander the Great was initiated into the Egyptian mysteries. And I'll come back to him presently, because now I want to pass on to the Greek mysteries. They're the most famous. They lasted hundreds of years. Now, the Greek mysteries were famed all over Europe. Hundreds of people from all over Europe came to take part in them. And there was two main divisions of the Greek mysteries, the lesser and the greater. The lesser took place at Athens at the vernal equinox every year. The greater took place at Eleusis, which was 12 miles north of Athens, at the autumnal equinox. And the authorities are not quite sure whether that took place every year or every 5 years. No, they're not quite sure. But that took place at the autumnal equinox. Now, at Eleusis, 12 miles north of Athens, there was an enormous temple dedicated to Demeter, the earth goddess. It was so large that it held 20,000 people. And I must tell you more about that. You see, at Eleusis lived the Hierophant. There were two hereditary saintly families. One was the Hierophant. They were called the Eumolpidae. Always the Hierophant came from that saintly family. And either his wife or his sister was the counterpart of him, the accompanying Hierophant. Now, he was a very holy person. He wore special white garments, white wool, and he was never allowed to be addressed by his name. And he had a special privilege that also belonged sometimes to the Vestal Virgins. That means to say that if he met a criminal going to execution, if he thought proper, he could abrogate the sentence. Another characteristic of the Hierophant was his very melodious voice. I think I've got what they said about that. Where have I got it? I can remember the words. Who poured forth winning utterance, whose voice the catechumen ardently desired to hear. Now, that reminds me of another thing in the Revelations. Do you remember where it says his voice was as the sound of many waters? There's a lot in that, friends. You know that a really spiritually minded person never has a harsh or unpleasant voice. There's two physical parts of you that are very much affected by your spiritual development, your voice and your eyes. So you see, the Hierophant had, you poured forth winning utterance. Well then, the other saintly family, I think they were called the Didaci. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. They were the hereditary heralds. They had to proclaim the mysteries every year. And they proclaimed it something like this. Over the temple in Demeter, there was a sentence. Let no one enter here with impure hands. Now, doesn't that remind you of the Psalms? Lord, who shall dwell in the tabernacle? Who shall rest upon thy holy hill? Even he that leadeth an incorrupt life, and doeth the thing which is right, and speaking the truth from his heart. Now, the Hierophant had the right to refuse initiation. And he once offended very deeply a Roman emperor by refusing him. Well, you can imagine that that was probably the beginning of the destruction of the mysteries. Well, then, do you see, the Didaci had to proclaim it. And I think they proclaimed it in words something like this, you know. Yes, let none approach these sacred mysteries who is of impure life or of a deformed body. I couldn't tell you why the deformed body stood in the way. Now, it was in the hands of the hereditary herald that the lesser mysteries were held at Athens. Quite numbers of people never went any further. Now, what happened at the lesser mysteries was something like this. I think it lasted about 3 months. Everybody collected, and they were in the charge of the priests, and they went into what you call a retreat. The priests instructed them. They followed certain dietary rules. I know one thing they were not allowed to eat was beans. I couldn't tell you why. And then they went through ceremonial lustrations and bathings in the sea. Now, and then they were instructed. And they were instructed in the cosmogony and the science and the mathematics and the music of that day. And the coping stone with spiritual knowledge. But you know, the most interesting are the greater mysteries. I'd like to talk about them. Hundreds sought initiation from all over Europe. Then the ancient initiation, says one of the ancient Greek writers, trained the body and the spirit. This is what the ancient Greek sage says. To attain to mastery, man needs a total remodeling of his physical, moral, and intellectual nature. This is possible only by the simultaneous exercise of the will, the intuition, and the reason. The soul possesses buried senses, which initiation rouses to life. By profound study and constant application, man can place himself in conscious relation with the hidden forces of the universe. He can attain to direct spiritual perception, open out for himself the paths of life beyond the grave, render himself capable of traveling along these paths. Then only can he say that he has conquered destiny and acquired his divine liberty, even here below. Then only can the initiate become the initiator, prophet and theurgist, a seer and creator of souls. Only he who is free can set others free. This is the ancient Greek. Now the further knowledge, the real knowledge, was given at Eleusis. At the temple of Eleusis, there were certain sacred objects, but I don't think anybody knows what they were. But when the term of the autumnal equinox was drawing near, the sacred objects were brought to Athens. And then the ceremonies began with a sacred march. I think it's very dramatic. I think that Lord Leighton painted a picture of this once. It was a ceremonial march which began at midnight. Now that was the march of 12 males. All those who were going to take part in the ceremonies joined in this march, carrying palm branches and singing. And the march was headed by the Vestal Virgins chanting and bearing the sacred objects, whatever they were. Can you just imagine that? Because it's quite possible that some of us sitting in this room took part in it in past lives. And so when at last they drew near to the temple of Demeter, they spent 10 days in the precincts of the temple. And what went on in that temple, we can only surmise more or less, because of course no one ever said. But you can gather quite a great deal from the writings of certain Greeks like Pindar the poet. There's one thing that was quite certain. They were artificially freed from their bodies. Now I'll tell you where I learned quite a lot about the Greek mysteries, from the writings of St. Clement of Alexandria. St. Clement, you know, was a Christian saint. He was initiated into the Christian mysteries. But before he was made a Christian and a bishop, and they made him a bishop in no time, in a few days, he had been initiated into the Greek mysteries. And he wrote a book called The Stromata. You can find it in the Antonine Library, which means the miscellany. In this book he writes, he hints what went on. He says, I think I've got his words here. He says, there were things of which we have no recollection, for the power that was in the blessed men was so great. But he says elsewhere, I say enough, I hint enough, to recall to the memory of any other who, like myself, has been struck with the thyrsus. Now, you know what that was? The thyrsus was a highly magnetized steel rod. They laid it against the spine of the candidate and freed him artificially from his body. Now, laying the body in a symbolic grave. Now, this is what the Greek poets tell us happened. You see, this is what Apuleius says. I drew near to the confines of death. I trod the threshold of Persephone. I was born through all the elements and returned herewith again. I saw the sun gleaming with splendor at dead of night. I approached the gods above and the gods below, and I worshipped them face to face. Now the result on the initiates was that they left the precincts of the temple, so Pindar tells us, with faces irradiated with joy. And so Pindar says, "Oh, happy one who goes beneath the hollow earth, having witnessed these mysteries. He indeed knows the issues of life." Of course, there came a time when the mysteries degenerated, and instead of really freeing the man and letting him roam the underworld, they enacted it allegorically. And Cicero was initiated. He says, "We at least have possessed reasons why we should live. And we're not only eager to live, but we cherish a better hope in death." Now, Pindar says that he said when he was freed of his body, he found himself in Amenti, that's what the Egyptians called it, the lower astral plane. Now, you know, the lower astral plane is beneath our feet in the center of the earth. And you know, it's the darkest and the densest of all the astral planes, the subplanes. There's no living thing there. There's vast mountains and scenery that's exactly like a Doré's picture. You know Gustave Doré's pictures. And the atmosphere is thick and turgid. And you know, in the Book of the Dead, the initiate says, "What is this place to which I have come?" You see, you had to show that you knew how to preach to the spirits in prison. Now, the best description of that I ever came across was a book written by an Oxford don who was also very clairvoyant. And in this book he describes a certain English general in the First World War. He was killed. He was a very good general and a very clever man, but he was a man of very, very evil life. And this friend, the Oxford Don, found him in this lower subplane. Do you know how he found his way out? Because nobody stays there forever. He saw a light and followed it. And what do you think the light was? It was the constant love and prayer of somebody who loved him upon earth. So you remember that. You can always pray for the spirits of the dead. You can always remember them, and it's like a light to them on the other side. Well, now then, he was surrounded, says Pindar, with horrifying sights and sounds. But pressing onward with courage, he said, "I found myself suddenly in the Elysian Fields." Now, you know what the Elysian Fields are? That's a higher astral plane. That's what the spiritualists call the Summerland. I have seen it once myself, only once. But the extraordinary thing is that the light and the air and the trees and the grass and the flowers and the water and everything there is sparkling, as if they were full of iridescent jewels. This is the Elysian Fields. He said, "I found myself in the Elysian Fields and in the presence of the gods." Now, that's what Pindar said. Now, I come to the appearance of the gods. They first started reading about the Eleusinian mysteries when I was in Adyar 50 years ago. It was a book by a Frenchman, Monsieur Foucault. He made a great study from vases and inscriptions and whatnot. And he says that the last thing that happened after those 10 days in the temple of Demeter was the appearance of the gods. Now, he says, of course, he said, consider all that had gone before. Consider all the preparation. Consider the atmosphere created. "The last thing I expect that happened," said he, "was curtains were drawn aside and the statues of the gods were exhibited." Now, I never believed Mr. Foucault. I couldn't believe it would produce that effect. But at last I found out what really happened. and I found it out from St. Clement and from a letter which is still extant from Alexander the Great to his mother. Alexander wrote to his mother after he'd been initiated in Egypt, and he said, "The Egyptian priests have shown me that the gods are men." Now, this is what St. Clement said, because after he was initiated into Greek mysteries, he was also initiated into the early Christian mysteries. Perhaps none of you ever thought there were such things in existence. There were in the first 500 years of the Christian religion. And he said that for 50 years after the death of the Lord Christ, he came back in the mysteries and appeared physically and taught the initiates. Now, that gave me the key. You know what the appearance of the gods was? At the last days in the temple of Demeter, consider the very sacred place it was, consider the atmosphere that had been created. I think that the adepts materialized and taught the people. No wonder they came out of the presence of Demeter, of the temple of Demeter, with faces irradiated with joy. No wonder, was it? I'm perfectly sure in my own mind that that's what happened. Wasn't it wonderful? But you see, it's possible that I said to you that some of us took part in that. And now I just want, before I stop, I want to talk a bit about the Christian mysteries. Do you remember the words of the Christ to his apostles? "To you it is given to know the mystery of the kingdom of God. But to them that are without, all these things are done in parables." And you know, we've got the word profane, and we think that means some rather villainous person. But you know what it really means? It's the Latin profanum. The fanum was the sacred, and the profanum were the ones in the outer court. That's all it meant, really. "To them which are without in the outer court, in parables, in allegories, in symbol," which is preserved in a way down to this day. Oh, you know, Madame Bavesky, oh, I'll come to that directly because I've got what she says. I must remember, because a lot of the Roman Catholic churches, the ancient ritual taken over bodily from the heathen. And so then Ignatius, the Bishop of Antioch, you know, Ignatius was eaten by lions in the Colosseum. And when he heard he was doomed to this awful fate, he said, "I will become the bread of God." Well, Ignatius was a very holy man. He says in one letter, "Even I, though I am bound for Christ, am able to understand heavenly things. The angelic orders," that's one thing they taught in the Christian mysteries, "the sublimity of the Spirit, the kingdom of the Lord, and above all the unconquerable majesty of Almighty God. Though I am acquainted with all these things, yet am I not therefore by any means perfect, or such a disciple as is Paul or Peter." Now, about the Christian mysteries, they were celebrated by the different Gnostic bodies. And if anybody's particularly interested in the Gnostics, see, we had in the old days in our society a great authority on the Gnostics, Mr. Mead. I've heard him lecture lots of times about Basilides and Valentinus and all the great Gnostics. He made a tremendous study of them, so if you're interested, you get all of his books. So I think some of them are out of print today. Well, now you see, the Christian mysteries, St. Clement tells us about in that book of his, The Stromata. I told you, he said that the Christ came back for 50 years after his death and appeared to the initiates in the mysteries. And this is what HBB says, because you see, when the Bishop of Rome took over, so to say, and the darkness of the Middle Ages descended over Europe, quite a great deal of this ancient knowledge was still preserved in the Vatican, HBB says. I told you they took over the terms of the ancient heathen religions. No, I won't call them heathen, the ancient Rome. For instance, now one of the great titles of the Pope is Pontifex Maximus. That means the great bridge builder. But Pontifex Maximus was the special title of the Flamen of Jupiter in Rome. And one past incarnation of the Master Kutumi was the Flamen of Jupiter. And I remember HBB told Mr. Sinnott how he was a Roman noble in those days, and he even gave him his name. But the HBB says this about it. Certain learned church fathers, she says, some of whom had been personally initiated into the ancient mysteries, like St. Clement, during the performance of which the arcane doctrines were allegorically enacted. And the arcane teachings at least were partially known to several of the fathers of the church. For example, Clement of Alexandria, his disciple Origen, both of them taught reincarnation, had themselves been initiated into the mysteries before adding to Neoplatonism of the Alexandrian school that of the Gnostics under the Christian veil. More than this, some of the doctrines of the secret schools, though by no means all, are preserved in the Vatican and have since become part and parcel of the mysteries in the shape of disfigured additions made to the original Christian dogmas. Such is now the materialized dogma of the Immaculate Conception. Now, do you see? I think that's very interesting. And just talking for a minute about reincarnation. You know, perhaps some of you, like me, were a little bit worried when you were a child about the story about Esau and Jacob. I thought Jacob was so awfully mean, I couldn't make out why the Lord approved of him. And evidently St. Clement had the same idea, because he says, I suspect that the cause for this lies in some anterior birth. So you see, he evidently believed in reincarnation. Well, now, do you see, reincarnation was extirpated about the 6th century from the Christian teaching. You've got to remember, if anybody's particularly interested in this, I hope I'm not going on too long, you should really read the final chapters of Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, because it shows you the quick and rapid spread of the Christian religion. But sometimes it happened like this. Some ruler or king or autocrat decided to become a Christian. He ordered all his subjects to be baptized, whether they really understood what was happening or not. Well, that meant that a vast body of ignorant men came into the church. That's why they ousted the Gnostics. And you know, Constantine called a meeting, this is in the 6th century, at Constantinople, up as the Eastern Church, to deal with what some people in the church by that time considered the heresy of believing in reincarnation. And you know, Constantine wasn't a very admirable man. He put off being baptized till he thought he was dying, because, you know, he just wanted to have a good time before he really became a Christian. Well, however, Constantine called this meeting, and they passed a resolution that worded something like this: whosoever shall believe, shall believe in the existence of the soul before birth, and shall hold the consequently wonderful opinion of its return, let him be anathema. That means cursed. Now, in spite of that, you know, it never really went out of the Christian religion. Heretical bodies like the Waldenses and the Cambridge Platonists and the Rosicrucians and whatnot, they all held it and taught it right down secretly, down through the Middle Ages. Never quite went. I found it in the puritanical Milton. Of course, Milton was a great student of the esoteric book of the Jews called the Zohar. And he, you know, in a poem of his on the death of a fair infant, he said, "Wert thou that just maid who once before forsook this hated earth, and camest thou to visit us once more?" Even puritanical Milton, just think. But now you see, then she goes on to say, yes, Now I come to the last thing, and that I want to talk about, and that's the Arcane School for the Future. You know, I gave this lecture to the English convention, but they wouldn't have the title, the Arcane Schools of the Past and the Future. They would insist on putting in Arcane Schools of the Past and the Present and the Future. Well, I tell you why I didn't really approve of that, because I don't think we've got Arcane Schools of this caliber at this present moment. We've got what you might call preparatory schools. Well, but now think of the future. Just let's spend the last 5 minutes thinking about that. I tell you what I've heard Mrs. Besant say, and of course you've all heard it too, that one of the things that the great adept, the Brotherhood, is going to do when the world is really at peace and war has gone and poverty is gone. You see, they're both on the way out. Don't ever think otherwise. And you might say, why poverty? I'll just dwell on that for a minute. You know, I heard Mrs. Besant say things in Adyar years ago that I've never forgotten. But nobody's ever written them down. So I wrote them down so they shouldn't be lost. And this is one thing she told us. You know, she said things sometimes that weren't written down. She said one day the Master Moria spoke to her. He said, I will tell you the meaning of democracy. He said, it means the vast mass of men who in the past have been slaves. Stop a minute, because we've been slaves in the past. You've got to remember that Egypt, Greece, and Rome had enormous numbers of slaves. If they conquered a people, they enslaved them. Well, you see, that doesn't happen anymore. He said, they are reaching a point in their evolution when their spiritual unfoldment can commence. But it is held up and hindered and frustrated by the inequality and uncertainty of life. Now, isn't that true? Now, this is the real reason why there's such enormous social changes taking place. Why are you talking about governments, looking welfare governments and whatnot? This is the real reason. And then he said another thing that Mr. Besant told us. We have decreed, said he, that's the great Brotherhood, this must begin to leave the world within the next 30 years. Well, the 30 years is up, and it is beginning to leave the world. Now, when poverty has gone and war has gone, I don't think it's very far distant, they will be able to come back. And Mrs. Besant said, the masters will come out into the world and take an active part in human affairs. And they will restore again the ancient arcane schools called the mysteries. Now, wouldn't it be wonderful? Let's you and I train ourselves as much as we can in preparation for that day. Wouldn't it be wonderful if instead of learning about life after death and the astral plane and all the conditions, you were set free of your body and you saw it was for yourself? Now, wouldn't it? Perhaps some of you remember bad dreams. I can remember quite a good deal of bad dreams. But just think if you really saw it. And besides, behind the mysteries, always the great arcane schools. And remember, they always took place at sacred spots. Perhaps this will become one. Certainly, Adyar will. And you see, with the great Hierophant living there. I remember Mrs. Besant telling us that she always hoped that one day an adept, a master of the wisdom, would live at Adyar. Well, let's hope. You see, she hoped that, so why shouldn't we? And then she said, when that happens, then you see what you and I will really. It'll be wonderful occult training. But you know, most of us by that time will be in bodies of the sixth sub-race, which is far better adapted than the present fifth-root race bodies. Now, this is all in the future. That's what I call the arcane schools of the future. I'm quite sure they're coming. Absolutely sure in my own mind. Well, now, you see, and there we are doing our best to get ready. Get the world ready. Get the world at peace and happy. And the spiritual evolution of man possible. Because, you know, I might mention just in talking, because Professor won't be talking to you again. So excuse me being a wee bit over time. You know, we're entering the Aquarian Age. Next year, 1960, the sun moves into the sign of Aquarius. Now, you know what the symbol of Aquarius is? It's a man pouring water out of a pot. Let's put it in the words, the lovely poetic words of Isaiah. You know, I love the prophets because they're such wonderful poetry. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. For the knowledge of God will cover the earth like the waters cover the sea. Now that's the keynote of the coming age. And war will have gone from this poor, distressful planet forever and ever for the rest of its life. So will poverty. They're two sides of the same medal. If you had one, you wouldn't have the other. If you didn't have one, you wouldn't have the other. And now I'm going to close what I'm talking about with the words of H.P.B. You know, when I was last in Adio about 6 or 7 years ago, Mr. Krishnamurti asked me to make a simplified edition of The Key to Theosophy. So I sat there and did it. And I think it's rather a good idea because I took out some of the very old-fashioned sounds and quotations don't bear on to present day. But it is a wonderful book. I hope you all read it. Now, it's all in question and answer form, and I heard that she wrote it by getting all the people around her to ask her questions, and then she answered them, and then that's how she wrote the book. Now, somebody asked her, what about the future? And she answers, but I must tell you that during the last quarter of every 100 years, an attempt is made by the masters to help on the spiritual progress of humanity in a marked and definite way. Towards the close of each century, you will invariably find an outpouring of spirituality, or you can call it mysticism, has taken place. Some one or more persons have appeared in the world as their agents, and a greater or lesser amount of occult knowledge and teaching has been given out. The secret doctrine was given out in 75, you see. If the present attempt in the form of our society succeeds, then it will be in existence as an organized, living and healthy body when the time comes for the effort of the 20th century. The general condition of men's minds and hearts will have been improved and purified by the spread of its teachings, and their prejudices and dogmatic illusions will have been, to some extent at least, removed. Not only so, but besides a large and accessible literature ready to men's hands, now we've got that, haven't we? The next impulse will find a numerous and united body. Well, that's why I'm very keen on us all being united. Of people ready to welcome the new torchbearer of truth. He will find the minds of men prepared for his message. A language ready for him, in which to clothe the new truths that he brings. An organization awaiting his arrival, which will remove the merely mechanical and material obstacles and difficulties from his path. You see, when the great torchbearer arrives, we can organize the meetings for him. We're all over the world now. Think how much one to whom such an opportunity is given could accomplish. The last time, you see, HBB, for instance, hadn't got an organization ready for it. Consider all this and tell me whether I am too sanguine when I say that if the Theosophical Society survives and lives true to its mission, to its original impulse, she warned us about being led off on psychic sandbanks, through the next 100 years. Tell me, I say, if I go too far in asserting that Earth will be a heaven in the 21st century in comparison with what it is now. Now, isn't that a wonderful future? Aren't you pleased to think about it and work towards it?